You got to get profitable with what you got. So it starts with profitability. And I got to get to my profit target first. And then I get to my cash, my best possible cash flow, my trade capital percentage second. And then I decide, you know, I'm not thinking about growth. I'm just trying to optimize what's in my hands that I'm doing.
Yeah.
Because why would you grow a business that's broken? It ain't going to get better by growing it.
Welcome to Mission to Grow, the small business guide to cash, compliance, and the war for talent. I'm your host, Mike Vinoy. Each week, we'll bring you experts in accounting, finance, human resources, benefits, employment law, and more. You'll learn ways to access capital through creative financing and tax strategies, tactical information you need to stay compliant with ever-changing employment laws, and people strategies you need to win the war for talent. Mission to Grow is sponsored by Assure. Assure helps more than 100,000 businesses get access to capital, stay compliant, and develop the talent they need to grow. Enjoy the show. Growth capital, scaling your business profitably. So we talk all the time on the show, there's two types of capital that businesses need to grow their business. You need human capital. How do you acquire and retain and develop a productive workforce, especially in today's world where there's a war for talent? But the other is more obvious, perhaps, but I think probably even less understood. That's financial capital. Have a great guest on today to talk about this subject. He's a guest speaker. He's an entrepreneur. He's a financial expert. His firm has been named the Inc. 5000 list. He's presented over 15 countries. He's a frequent speaker to groups like EO, Scaling Up, Vistage, and Acetech. Author of Simple Numbers, Straight Talk, Big Profits, and Simple Numbers 2.0 Rules for Smart Scaling. Great books. I've read both. Highly recommend. He's a partner at Carr, Riggs & Ingram, a top 25 accounting and advisory firm. Welcome back to the show, Greg Crabtree. So, you know, for everybody else, I was kind of joking here with Greg before the show. I almost think of Greg as like Dave Ramsey is to personal finance what Greg is to small business owners and mid-sized companies. It's you get past the gap accounting, the debits, the credits, the double entry accounting stuff that I think just unnecessarily confuses business owners and just talks, you know, straight talk in real world practical terms. So I say it as a compliment, and I think it's maybe a great intro to today. Growth capital. So I think when entrepreneurs, business owners think about growth capital, they might think, okay, how do I go get a loan? Or maybe I got an angel investor and I'm just going to start on advertising campaign. I'm going to hire some sales reps. I'm going to develop a new product. But I think no surprise that happens with very mixed results. Sometimes you get growth, sometimes you don't. Sometimes it's profitable growth. Sometimes it's very unprofitable growth. And you have a pretty practical plan for how businesses should be thinking about this. So Greg, what do you think the number one mistake businesses make when they start acquiring and dare I say, isolating growth capital?
Well, I mean, there's a couple of issues. Number one is people misapply a concept when they don't have the same type of business that the example they heard or were told, you know, is they don't have that type of business, that type of capital structure. And so in our research of privately held businesses, I mean, essentially you fall into one of three capital profiles. You're either capital light, capital moderate, capital heavy. So what do I mean by that?
Yeah.
So a capital light business, which everybody would love to have. I don't carry accounts receivable. I don't carry inventory. So I get paid upon service. I might even get paid in advance for my product or service. That's a capital light business. The only capital typically that I'm required to fund the business is my 2 months of operating cash. And so that's a business that actually ought to achieve greater than 100% return on invested capital as a target, typically closer to 150. You know, so you invest $1 million in a capital light business, and you're making $1.5 million a year profit, that's a pretty good deal.
Yeah, right.
But those are execution heavy businesses.
Yeah.
All right.
Can you give a couple examples of what that might look like?
I mean, you know, typically, you know, so, you know, a software as a service kind of business. Now you had ramp of you spent money, you know, to kind of build it up. But at the end of the day, I mean, you know, I'm getting paid for something at the first of the month, and I'm billing in advance. One of my favorite models that exists is IT managed service provider companies. Those companies bill at the first of the month on a per seat basis. They have a staff that, so they carry no receivables. They don't carry even any equipment anymore. Everything is, they just resell server space. Typically, an IT managed service provider business only has the 2 months cash as their capital. And if they hit their profit target, we have a lot of clients in that industry, you know, they should be 150% return on invested capital.
Yeah.
You know, so that's a good example. But a lot of service businesses have adopted a similar model to the IT MSPs. There's several digital marketing agencies that have tried to adopt that same kind of model, and it does work if you're a good agency. There's law practices that are specialty practices, specialty service practices, not like a personal injury or something like that. But if you have a particular practice focus of a specialty, you know, you would bill in advance. You're not waiting to get paid. And so when you have market power, the people come to you and you can bill in advance, you really take a significant capital component out of the equation.
Yeah.
So capital moderate.
Yeah.
Capital moderate is you have one of two things. I either carry accounts receivable or I carry inventory, but I don't carry both. Typically, those kinds of businesses need to target about a 65 to 75% return on invested capital. So for some reason, the market won't let you bill in advance, so you have to carry accounts receivable, or you're carrying inventory, but I get paid upon a sale of what I have in inventory, so I don't have to carry receivables. So that's a capital moderate business.
And then I'm going to stop you. Give me a couple examples of a capital moderate business then.
I mean, you know, like a retail store, a retail business, a wholesaler is a wholesaler that sells, like one of our clients is in the remainder product business. You know, they carry inventory, but when they sell stuff, you have to pay for it. They're not waiting to get paid, you know, so they're dealing in an industry where, you know, we ain't giving you terms. So you want this inventory, which is a high potential margin for the reseller. Hey, you got to pay in advance, you know, before they ship it.
So maybe a retailer, they got to carry the inventory.
A retailer, they carry inventory, but they don't carry receivables.
Yeah. And maybe a service business that's so competitive or mature, you can't charge in advance, but you don't carry inventory, but you might bill net 30 on your services.
Yeah. And so, like I said, so in a services, like I said, where competition requires you to provide terms. Now, the other thing that will force you to provide terms is a smaller niche business might be able to get paid in advance and stay ahead. But as you move upscale with bigger customers, especially, you know, the Fortune 1000 customers, those guys are going to beat you in the head, and you'll start giving them 60 and 90 day terms.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's not necessarily all good. Right. You know, so you gotta understand terms come with where you are in the market and as you play upscale or down. And then the heaviest one is the worst one and the hardest, that you target a 50% return on invested capital, is I sell on account and I'm carrying inventory. Yeah, so I have finished goods. I'm either a wholesaler, reseller, maybe a manufacturer, but I'm carrying inventory and I'm carrying receivables waiting to be paid.
Yeah.
And so the first thing when you think about capital signature is you have to think of, am I light, moderate, or heavy? And then that establishes then the target. On the other side, though, and this is where accounting fails the entrepreneur. So the things I just described refer to what we refer to as trade capital. Now, traditionally, the industry is referred to that as working capital. So I made a slight modification of working capital because I consider the common term of working capital, which is current assets that will turn it, that are either cash or turn into cash within a 12-month period, minus current liabilities, which will have to be paid within the next 12 months, which includes my current debt service as well. The net of those is what's traditionally and called working capital. What we decided though is you know, that number is mixing things that shouldn't be mixed. So we take working capital and exclude cash and debt. And so what we'll have left over is what we call trade capital. And it is a powerful, powerful understanding of your capital signature of your business. Trade capital, like I said, is current assets minus current liabilities, but ignore cash and ignore debt. And these are the things that turn over in your business. AR, inventory, work in progress, minus accounts payable, deferred revenue if I can bill in advance. Mm-hmm. Accrued expenses where maybe I owe commissions, but I can delay paying them, for one reason or another.
So the rationale for separating out debt and cash is things like AR and inventory, they turn.
Cash is a choice and debt is a choice.
Yeah, right. That makes good sense.
Trade capital are forces of the market. Cash and debt are choices that you make of how you fund the business, whether or not you keep cash in the business, whether you take distributions,
right?
All of those things. And so you've got to isolate things that are dissimilar. And those trade capital things work off of each other.
And then I think the old adage, you can't improve what you can't measure, what you don't measure. So if you isolate cash and debt, which really, even if it doesn't feel like it at times, it is your choice how you deal with those things. Yeah. If it's inventory and AR, for example, those are things that you can work. You can drive your DSO down.
And I can play them off of each other.
Right. Right.
And more than likely, I actually play them off of the other side. So I'm netting an asset with a liability, which is actually the right way to look at it. Because accountants, we put assets on the left and liabilities on the right. Well, no, we need to net the functional things that connect together is a more effective presentation. And what we look for is once we get that trade capital number isolated, we look at it as a percentage of revenue. And so this is what we refer to as the cash power ratio, CPR. The cash power ratio is when I have trade capital of 10% to revenue on an average basis, and we monitor this on a running basis. We look, is it getting higher? Is it getting lower? You know, and most people have a very consistent signature of that number. When my trade capital is at 10% and my profit is at 5%, the next $1 million that I grow, I'm going to burn 5% of cash of that revenue before I collect the first positive dollar to my bank account.
Hmm.
So that is a very quick way of understanding the cash flow consequences of growth. Now, what is powerful is once we kind of unlocked this metric and showed it to entrepreneurs on a consistent monthly basis in our calls, guess what? The Hawthorne principle kicked in. That thing that you look at will move just merely by looking at it. And that 10% trade capital and the 5% profit, once we showed it to them over and over every month, all of a sudden trade capital comes to 7, profit goes to 10, and we're now 3% cash flow positive on every new sale. That's powerful. That is a big, 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 big difference in how you grow a business.
Where does the light bulb first come on for folks to start managing their business in this way?
Well, I mean, the first thing we have to show them the data, which this is not a traditional financial presentation. The right. Accountants go around the world. I mean, you know, gosh, if I showed you a cash flow statement, your eyes would roll back in your head and you would lay down on the floor and do the dying bug. You know, and it's like, I don't know what that means.
Yeah.
It's like, no, listen, you know, for every $1 million in new revenue, I've got to put 10% of my money into that. So where's the $100,000? Oh, wait a minute. I get profit off of that. So that is money that comes back to me, but I'm only getting profit at 5%. So where's my $50,000 of cash going to come from? Because I'm tapped out on my line and my cash balance is at 0. Well, that's called don't grow. We better hold things steady, let the cash catch up, build cash, and then I can now play the investment game. But there again, if I can get their head around turning over AR inventory, AP, and deferred revenue, netting it, because I get them to do more because I net the number and show them, listen, you got four options to work with. Pick one of them that's the most sensitive that you can affect. Yeah. Don't try to affect something the market's not going to let you affect. And there's all kinds of techniques. I mean, even though a customer crams down 60 days, you know, terms to you in AR, okay, well, maybe I can find a way to bill faster so that 60 is effectively 45. And then I can get my vendors to help me. And I'll give you a great example.
Yeah.
One of our clients was a Amazon reseller. And so this guy ended up buying out his partners. And so he went to his vendor. His vendors, you know, required him to pay in 30 days. Now he's selling through Amazon, which fortunately pays every 2 weeks. And so what you do sell, I mean, from that standpoint, as long as there's no hiccups in the issue, it works out really well. Yeah. But he's still negative a half a month in cash flow. And this guy lives off of a 3% gross margin.
Okay.
I'm 3% profit margin, 3% profit to revenue.
Yeah.
And so about a 13% gross margin. So, I mean, Amazon resellers are high velocity, you know, low margin businesses. I mean, and you're dealing with fractions in velocity, you know, in that kind of business. And there's a lot of ones like that. It's not just Amazon resellers. And so brilliantly, he goes to his suppliers and he says, hey, if you guys will give me 75 days instead of 30, I think I can sell 10 times as much. What do you think? Now, he had a good rep with him, and they said, okay, we'll test it out. Prove it to us. Guess what? He did. Now, what does that mean? He went from having to put his money in to fund growth. Okay. Remember, he's only at 3% profit. He would be approximately 10% trade capital percentage. So that's a negative 7% cash flow differential. So for every $1 million that he wants to grow in revenue, he's having to come up with $70,000 in cash.
Yeah.
And that he doesn't have. That's not good. So he solved the problem. Went to his vendors and said, listen, we can make this a win-win. Give me 75 days and I'll sell more of your stuff because I know I can do that.
Because what was holding him back wasn't demand in his ability to sell. It was his available cash to buy inventory and turn it.
Exactly. Right? And he was good at buying just what the market needed and having it high velocity turnover. So what happened was he now is cash flow positive on a sale. His profit, his trade capital percentage was in essence 1%, and his profit percentage was 3%. He was cash flow positive 2% on every new sale.
Right. Right.
His vendors essentially funded 100% of his inventory and half of his AR. And he grew without borrowing a single dime from his, it never touched his line of credit to grow.
So that's brilliant. I love it.
Exactly. Now, you may not get your vendors to agree to that. You may not be able to execute like he did to prove it, but those are techniques that are there for the taking for the people that are good at executing and good at treating their network of stakeholders. You know, your customers are a stakeholder, your vendors are a stakeholder, your bank is a stakeholder. You know, you got to treat all these people fairly and say there has to be a logical reason as to why you structure it that way.
Yeah. And so honestly, that just works for any business. That technique works for any business who, if the demand is there and you can turn the inventory,
right,
whatever that inventory is. What about on the, you mentioned another tactic. So on one hand, it's everybody can get the concept. I'm going to go to my vendors and, see if they'll, you know, lengthen terms. That's a good thing.
Right.
What about you? You mentioned, how do I bill faster? What are some techniques that the folks can use to get a bigger window, bigger cash window on the front side of that?
We call it be quabo, bill quickly, bill often. I just go nuts when I see somebody that waits to the end of the month to then send an invoice. I mean, unless somebody is forcing you into that, I want to bill on a much faster basis.
Yeah.
Contractors, a lot of times that we work in the contract industry of, you know, it doesn't matter if it's engineering, construction, you know, whatever type of contractor you are, that where there's materials and labor. Well, when I deploy materials, I should get paid I can send an invoice immediately for my deployment of materials. Now, generally I've got a supplier that's giving me terms on that, but as soon as I deploy it, I'm issuing an invoice for the materials. And so I should get paid for those materials before I have to pay the vendor. If I wait and bill the materials when I've done my labor, I'm now 30 days late in getting paid for those materials.
Right.
Now, people, I mean, a lot of it's just being honest. Just says, listen, I'm doing this work for your benefit. You know, I need to bill you and start the clock running. So I'm getting paid roughly about the time I've got to release payment on your behalf.
Yeah.
And what's unfair about that? Now, granted, now as you move up into the big boy and you got to put your big boy pants on, you know, if you go deal with Hitachi, they're going to cram down 90-day terms on you and might even pay you in 120 just because they feel like it.
Right.
And it's like, I've had clients that chose to not do business with those companies. Dell Computer was one of the worst. Dell loved to beat their chest about their negative 22-day cash cycle days, which meant on average, Dell collected a dollar from their customer 22 days before they had to pay anybody.
Hmm.
And that was just abusive.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, the fairness doctrine to me is, listen, you know, have the cash, my customer's cash needs to get to me when I'm incurring costs for the benefit of my customer, and we're treating everybody in the ecosystem fairly. And that works.
It almost sounds too obvious. Oh, here's your problem. Here's how you solve your growth, your capital needs for growth. Just to negotiate with your vendors to pay them slower, negotiate with your customers to get them to pay you faster. What are entrepreneurs missing?
They lack the discipline to follow through. They lack the ability to actually prove credibility to customers and vendors to do things that they said. And so to get those exceptional terms, those generally move towards the exceptional businesses in that industry that do what they say and say what they do. And if you can't do those things, then you're going to get the worst terms. You're not going to be trusted. Because here's the thing. In my bio, you may mention I've spoken in 15 countries around the world.
Yeah.
And a lot of those are not first world countries. The thing I found about business is, you know, labor efficiency concepts that we talk about all the time are really the same internationally as they are in the U.S. And Canada and Australia, you know, any developed markets. The only thing that is different about business internationally in a third world country are terms.
Hmm.
So generally in a third world country, I spoke in the United Arab Emirates right before COVID, and I was speaking to the EO chapter in Oman, one of the Emirates. And I was talking to the guys and they were saying, yeah, you know, a lot of them did business with the government, and the government traditionally paid in about 6 months to a year in many cases. But yet the government was trying to tout entrepreneurism. And I said, listen, guys, you just need to have you come back and talk to your finance minister, and I can help them tout and improve entrepreneurism. If the government becomes the best payer, the market will coalesce around that. And there's no Oman had the money. I mean, they got plenty of oil.
Yeah.
And the government budget was profitable at $60 a barrel, you know, was the kind of their strike price to where, you know, they had plenty of money. So cash was not an issue. This was just lack of understanding of the ecosystem of how entrepreneurism works. And so, you know, when I need trade credit and confidence that when I submit an invoice, and we can complain about the U.S. federal government all we want, but they're a really good payer. They pay in a structured way in a very quick period of time that is world class. And so that helps. People do not understand every time that there's a government shutdown and that payment system becomes fractured because of government budget, government bills being withheld for just a couple of weeks, it sends ripples throughout the U.S. economy back because the U.S. government's the biggest customer to the whole economy by a long shot. And so that is a shock to the cash flow system. But if you get to where there's trust with the customer, trust with the vendor, you're in the middle as the provider of product or service or both, then you know, the only difference between a third world economy and a first world economy is the third world economy margin takes this long to go through a transaction cycle from start of transaction to completion in finance. In a first world economy, it goes through this fast.
That's really insightful. I want to spend the last back half of our conversation on exactly that, because I suspect a lot of people probably listening today thinking, growth capital. I'm gonna get some great ideas from some new ways to get loans, right? There's probably how credible is your story is going to lend itself a lot to that. So I want to spend some time talking about that. But this is not a show on factoring, right? In creative finance techniques.
Well, those are drunk driver rate financing. So really the idea, what we teach is how to grow out of your own cash flow. Even if you have a difficult cash flow signature, you know, to trade capital to profit, we can still teach those businesses how to grow with their own cash and stay off the line of credit. One of the classic misunderstandings of what a line of credit is there for. A line of credit is there for a temporary disruption in normal activity. Right. And if you go talk to a banker, a line of credit that does not go to zero for 30 consecutive days in a 12-month period is called an evergreen loan by the regulators, which means I have borrowed capital, which is very dangerous. Borrowed capital is betting with somebody else's money, and you still have to pay the bookie.
Right.
So the idea is we want to teach people to, you know, our philosophy of a fully capitalized business is having 2 months of operating expenses with zero drawn on a line of credit. Now, I'm okay with term debt against a productive asset. I go buy a vehicle. Fine. Finance it over six years. I go buy a piece of, I go buy a CNC machine. Fine. Finance it over 5-6 years. If I go buy a work truck, fine. A building. Fine. You know, you got your normal for a built when you get to real estate, you got to put 20% down. So that's your capital contribution, but the rest of it's fine. And once again, that's what we call infrastructure capital. And the thing is, there are very few businesses in the U.S. that have much in the way of infrastructure capital anymore. We are a very service industry dominant economy, but there are some that do, and we have some that do that. And what we teach them is, listen, don't blow my cash trying to pay cash for equipment that could be financed over its useful life. I want to serve my cash for my buffer. I'm my own line of credit in essence, because the reason why we came up with a 2-month core capital target is I studied 4 years of our clients' data when I was writing the first book. And I said, what is the deepest negative cash flow that any business experiences in a 3-4 year period? And it was 2 months worth of cash. Or 2 months worth of operating expenses, things you don't get terms on, labor and OPEX, not cost of goods sold that you get terms from a vendor. And as it the number has proven flawless since, you know, for the last 15 years, I came up with that number to get people to get off their line of credit and hold cash in the business. Now, I get clients trying to lobby for 3 and 4 months. So I've got them on the other end of the spectrum. And I said, no. Any dollar amount above the 2 months is excess cash that you're only getting your overnight interest rate on.
Yeah.
But up to the 2 months number, I'm getting a 50, 75, or 100% return on that money because it's core to the business. And that's how, and it is included. And when we do return on invested capital calculations, we put the 2 month cash number in there, whether you have it or not. I'm not letting you create a high return on invested capital that's leveraged, you know, through line of credit. It's fine if it's leveraged on an operating piece of equipment, as long as you need that piece of equipment and it can continue to be productive.
I think a lot of people probably think, okay, maybe it's a bit of an old school, but still pretty common brick and mortar retail kind of a business. You gave examples, hey, buying some equipment, buying a building, some real estate. I need a service truck. Maybe I need to fund payroll for it. So maybe I have a 5-location business and I'm going to open a 6th location somewhere else.
Well, let me give you a location example. So this is one, a guy that's not a client of mine, but he was in the audience in a presentation I was giving in Omaha, Nebraska. And he has a series of 15 transmission stores. And I said, Pete, I'm going to use you as an example. He said, let me see how close I can get to the numbers. I said, you're thinking about opening the 16th location. Great. So what that means is it's going to cost you about $1 million for the dirt and put up a metal building for that location. And you got to put down $200,000 and the bank will finance $800,000. I said, let's start there. Is that a pretty good guess? He says, yep, that's exactly what we aim for. I said, great. Okay. Step one. So the $200,000 that I've got to put in of my own money for the down payment, that's invested capital. It says, now, You've got some operating losses when the store opens. I've got, you know, some other stuff to get the store ready. So I'm going to spend about $200,000 to get the store open before it breaks even by typically the 3rd to 4th month, you know, of the business.
Which would be pretty fast, I would think.
Yeah. It's pretty fast, but you know, that's a business that there's not enough of. And so they get there pretty quick. And he smiled and he says, that's exactly the number we use. All right. So that's 400,000 input. So that business, we want a minimum 50% return on invested capital. Now I'll take more, but that's one where I want a minimum 50% return. So success for that store is taking 400,000 times 50% is 200,000. I need 200,000 in annual profit for that to be a success. 200,000 divided by 12 is $16,833 a month. I said, you hit success when the store hits $16,800 a month on a continual basis or more in profit. And Pete kind of paused and he said, well, you know, what you just told me in 2 minutes took me 35 years to figure out. But that's it. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of nuance. There's energy, there's culture, there's all of these other things of business. But I mean, the physics of entrepreneurial finance have been staring at us in plain sight for decades. And people just keep wanting to try to come up with the easy button solution. And it's not there. These are fundamentals that have characteristics that when you look at every type of business that you're doing, you have to stay within those characteristics and you have to use those targets or else you're playing Russian roulette at a really high stakes per pull.
That's what just keeps going through my mind. That's the perfect example of Russian roulette. Like I'm sure somebody's gonna go to YouTube and they're gonna type in growth capital and they're gonna find this video, and it's not gonna be techniques to go convince the banker to loan you money, but I think that's I've seen a lot of pitch decks and that's really what they are. Whether it's
but you know what, Mike, you know, when people follow these principles, the banks don't have any problem loaning you money when you need it,
and that's exactly where I was gonna go. It's like. If your pitch deck is all about, hey, here's the total addressable market, you know, here's how this massive market, and if all I need is this one little percentage slice, that's all. Okay, that's interesting.
Right. You know, when I came up with these principles of return on invested capital, my profit target, labor efficiency ratio, core capital target, I've not had to worry about loan covenant documents for my clients. I mean, I will tell you, only 20% of I've talked about before, our 100 company model that we track for our economic data of our clients all across the U.S., only 20% of those clients have anything drawn on a line of credit. I mean, that's how these people have bought in to this idea and create success, because, you know, they're not living on the edge of their line.
Yeah.
Because they understand those principles. I don't have to worry about what the covenant says, because they'll meet every covenant that the bank can think up, you know, for the most part. But so, when you're flying close to the sun, I mean, you know, you're having to go to the bank and beg for forgiveness because you missed a covenant, and you hope that things will turn around and they won't take your house.
So how does a business, what's other than being a client of yours, and you know, if that happens as a result of the show, awesome. That's not necessarily the intent of the show. The intent of the show is to provide good information. How do businesses get there? Because it seems like the first thing you got to understand your own numbers first. You have to understand your own cash power ratio, right? Mm-hmm. You got to understand what type of a business you are, what your, you know, where do you start if you're an entrepreneur?
It's a phrase we repeat often every day. You got to get profitable with what you got. So it starts with profitability. And I got to get to my profit target first. And then I get to my best possible cash flow, my trade capital percentage second. And then I decide, you know, I'm not thinking about growth. I'm just trying to optimize what's in my hands that I'm doing.
Yeah.
Because why would you grow a business that's broken? It ain't going to get better by growing it. You got to fix it where it sits.
How often do you see business owners, and I confess I've been in them, where I've thought about, oh, we just got to get scale and I'm going to worry about margin later, and then margin never materialized. How often do you see that where the business doesn't really understand even how they, I don't want to say in the condescending way, but how do they really understand whether they're making money or not, and whether they have something that can scale?
I mean, our initial interaction with a new client is, I mean, I would say 80% of them don't really have a clear picture of their financial standing, because traditional financial statements are opaque. I mean, you know, you just can't,
right.
They don't talk, they're mute. And so what we do in our simple number structure is to get the data to tell a story.
Yeah.
And when the data can tell its story, then it's like, oh gosh, you know, it's sick. How do we fix this? Well, there's a cure. You may not like the cure. And then, you know, as you understand the targets and everything that you've got to go get, then you move into more the finesse of lines of business, what we call the profit cube. You know, what's the profitability of each customer relationship? What's profitability by project, by location, by team member, or by team, in all of those? And so as you really start to take people from survivable, either, there was one client, I mean, we literally, they were $55 million in revenue, losing $2.5 million a year in income, or $2.5 million loss. I mean, so they're not long for this world. And we basically dug into their product matrix and showed them the SKUs that they had to stop selling or fix. Take your pick, but here's the fix, you know, solution. Here's the stop solution.
Yeah.
But we got them to drop from $55 million to $35 million in revenue, but be $1 million profitable.
Yeah.
And so what do you want to be $55 million and lose $2.5 million, or do you want to be $35 million and make $1 million?
Right.
Which one do you want?
Yeah.
because the $55 million business is losing $2.5 million isn't worth anything. It's worth less than zero.
Right. So. Unless you are growing with positive cash flow on that loss, you're out of business eventually. So,
there's some times where you are so bad, you've got good revenue that you're so bad at executing at, somebody will buy you out of a problem. But generally, they're smart enough to not give you the value for what they know how to do. A good buyer knows that.
And there are exceptions that come out of the software world where, Salesforce.com is a multi-billion dollar company. They've never had a dime of profit, but the revenue line goes like this, and right? So
yeah, but those are ones that are generally funded by other people's money.
100%.
I have some clients that have some other people's money investments, but very few. I gravitate to the entrepreneur. Hey, I got skin in the game. I'm the funder. I'm the one at risk. And you can't pull off the stupid .com.
And I think those things are, I'll say guilty. Those things are shiny objects that sometimes entrepreneurs, I think, aim at and cling to and think that they can do that. But the reality is, you make a really big point about this in your books. It's about profit. It's not about revenue. Revenue is a vanity number. It's all about profit. Yep. If you don't have profit, you don't have a model that you can grow.
And actually what we've gravitated to more so is establishing targeted percentages of profit to gross margin, which we think is a far clearer, more comparable number across all different lines of business than, forget about revenue is just a starting point for math. Yeah. You know, your top line should be gross margin, which is revenue minus COGS without any of your labor. You can put subcontractors in there, but you can't put your labor in it. Gross margin is those pass-throughs. That's your true economic top line. And then your pre-tax profit for the U.S. Companies, because most U.S. companies that are private or flow-throughs, that taxes paid at the entrepreneur level personally. And so we focus on pre-tax profit because it's the same thing as a bond yield. I mean, if I buy $1 million treasury bond, what's my interest income? Well, it's taxable. Okay. Well, it's no different than a business. If I invest $1 million in a business, so you invest $1 million in a 2-year U.S. treasury, it's probably right around 5% right now. If I invest $1 million into a good business with a 50% return on invested capital, that's $500,000 annually it's making. That's why a privately held business that's well run in a market that's needed is the best investment you'll ever make.
Yeah, right.
Because like I said, the low end is 50%. Our 100 company model, the average return on invested capital is 75%. That's on $1 billion of revenue.
Greg, we could probably spend, a few hours talking about some of the best practices on optimizing.
Well, the next discussion here's what I've talked about today is capital that physically we can account for on the balance sheet.
Yeah.
Our next discussion though is there's a fourth version of capital. So on the balance sheet, you have your trade capital, which are those net things, our infrastructure capital, which is the fixed assets minus the debt connected to it. And then we have your core capital target, which is the 2 months cash number with zero drawn on a line of credit. Those three net numbers makes up everything on your balance sheet. The sum of them is your invested capital. Yeah. It excludes the trash on your balance sheet of due from shareholder, assets that you loan to a related party, you purchase something in the business that has nothing to do with the business. So it's excluding that kind of trash that sometimes builds up on entrepreneurs' balance sheets. So that's the business in its purest form.
Yeah.
But there's a fourth capital, and we'll tease this for next time. It's called launch capital. Now, I named the baby because there wasn't a name for it. And the launch capital lives on your P&L. Because accounting does not have rules, and we've created some techniques to deal with this, of I'm intentionally spending money to lower profitability in this accounting period to get the economic gain in a future accounting period.
Yes.
Nobody stuck a gun to my head and made me spend it. I chose to lower profitability myself, to hire a person who wasn't fully utilized, to invest in technology to run a more efficient business, to spend surge money on marketing to penetrate a market. All of those count.
Yeah, the complementary product line.
Exactly. Product development. We have got clients who do that. Those are launch capital concepts that we need a whole episode to just unpack that. But to me, all of our clients grow their business more, far, far more so through launch capital investing on the P&L than balance sheet investing. And that's actually the secret. That's the secret kernel of growth in entrepreneurism.
So I for sure want to make that our next conversation. That's super interesting. I think it is to me. I suspect it will be to other entrepreneurs. I think the punchline for today, and we can maybe unpack a couple more use cases. The punchline is, if you want to grow your business and you're looking for growth capital, whether it's debt or otherwise, you can't do it unless you have first a profitable business. You got to know your numbers, how you're making it, and you have to understand your own cash flow in a good, healthy business. By definition, should be able to fund its own growth, and if it's not, you don't realize that you have your baby's sick. Is that a fair way to look at it?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bessie's not giving milk. So we got to get Bessie healthy. You can keep your cow healthy and milk it every day, or you can starve it and have one barbecue dinner.
So if you're an entrepreneur, you're working your tail off. You're trying to, maybe it's too much of a throwaway phrase. You're trying to quote unquote grow your business, and you keep working harder and harder, and it's not happening. The reality is your business is sick and you don't know it. Right.
Yeah. The easy path, entrepreneurs try to hit the easy button and go get more cash rather than fix their profitability problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm telling you, if you can hit your profitability target, there's a way to fund the business. That's easy. But if you can't hit your profitability target, then nobody's going to fund you.
Right.
And at the end of the day, the best funding is self-funding. Because once you go through a couple of cycles and you get it to where you're cash flow positive on growth, then you're fine. You'll never talk to your banker again except to get football tickets when you need them. I'm a net depositor. I'm not a borrower.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a great tip. But anyway, all right. Well, I'm going to have to wrap up, but like I said, we'll tease them with the launch capital, because I think that's really the secret sauce of how you grow a business more so than anything. So,
Greg, enjoyed the conversation. And, I think we captured the foundation, and next time we'll talk about launch capital. Thank you.
All right. Sounds good. All right. Thanks.
Thanks to everybody else for joining today. If you enjoyed today, subscribe, like, share, comment. Until next time, thanks. That's it for this episode of Mission to Grow. Thanks for joining us today. For show notes and more episodes, visit us at missiontogrow.com. If you found this content valuable, I invite you to share it with a friend and subscribe to the show. If you really want to help, I'd love it if you left a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you listen. Mission to Grow is sponsored by Assure. Assure helps more than 100,000 businesses get access to capital, stay compliant, and develop the talent they need to grow. To learn more about how Assure can help your business grow, visit assuresoftware.com. Until next time.